Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to IJ's live call discussing our argument at the Supreme Court last week. We'll be talking about the case, Timms versus Indiana, and how IJ will move forward from here to rein in civil forfeiture nationwide. I'm Melanie Hildreth. I'm pleased to be here with IJ President and General Counsel Scott Bullock, who will be hosting our conversation, as well as IJ attorneys Wesley Hoddit, who argued the case, and Sam Gedge, his co-counsel. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Melanie, and thanks for everybody joining in on the call. I think probably just about everybody knows a little bit about the Timms case, and you might have watched the video that we sent around last week. But in just real brief summary, the Timms case presented three really important issues for us. One was this really important foundational constitutional question about incorporation. The Eighth Amendment's excessive fines clause, one of the few provisions of the Bill of Rights where the court has not ruled whether it's incorporated against state and local governments. And the Timms case will address that question for the first time. Of course, Timms arises in the context of an issue that IJ has pioneered, that you've all been reading about, that this outrageous practice of civil forfeiture. And this case was the first time in over 20 years that the court has had an opportunity to weigh in on civil forfeiture. And then the case also has the potential to impact our path-breaking work that we're doing challenging fines and fees schemes by municipal governments, a growing threat to property rights throughout the country. So needless to say, we were very excited about the opportunity to take up this case, and we're very glad to have the two co-counsel with us who litigated the Timms case. And I just wanted to start things off with Sam briefly to talk just a little bit about the facts of the case and how IJ got involved in the Timms case.
Sure, Scott. So the way we got involved was really kind of a mix of luck and timing, and IJ's pre-existing nationwide reputation as a leader when it comes to civil forfeiture. Wesley and I have, for the past couple of years, been working on a different forfeiture case out of Indiana, where Tyson Timms' case arises. And one day last November, our local counsel sent me an email saying this this opinion dealing with civil forfeiture just came down from the Indiana Supreme Court, thought you might like to take a look. Turns out it was Tyson Timms' case. And we weren't familiar with Tyson before then, but the Indiana Supreme Court's opinion really jumped out at us immediately as a perfect candidate for the U.S. Supreme Court's review. And just briefly as to what the case was about. So Tyson Timms lives in rural Indiana, and for a number of years he struggled with drug addiction. He was addicted to heroin. And in 2012, his father died, leaving Tyson a fairly large life insurance policy, around $70,000. Tyson spent about half of that on a new car and spent most of the rest feeding his heroin addiction. A couple of months after that, though, Tyson got contacted by someone who ended up being a confidential informant, who basically invited Tyson to sell a couple of grams of heroin to people who ended up being undercover cops. Tyson wasn't a drug dealer, but he was an addict and he was desperate, and this was an opportunity. So he's arrested, he pleads guilty, he's in probation now, he's under house arrest, and on top of that, though, the state decides to take his car. And for the past 6 years, Tyson's been fighting to get his car back through Indiana's really baroque civil forfeiture system.
Right. And this gives rise to the question of, is this an excessive fine or forfeiture then under the Eighth Amendment, or in the fundamental question of whether this even applies to state governments or local governments like those in Indiana. So, you know, this is a case that was a bit different than how IJ typically does cases. You know, our preference is always to take on cases from the ground up, from the trial court, and then litigate them all the way up through the court system. But we always, and we are increasingly looking for opportunities for cases that have the real potential to set precedent, that we think lend themselves to public interest litigation, and we can step in and take over the case like we did with Tyson, who would not have been able to do a cert petition. He wouldn't have been able to afford it, especially given the fact that the court takes under 1% of the cases that come before them. So we were so happy to be able to take over the case for Tyson, do the cert petition, and then have the court grant it. So we took over the case last November. The court granted review in June. And then, of course, we just argued the case last week, and I'd like to turn to the to the man of the hour last Wednesday when we argued the case before the court, Wesley Hoddit. And I just wonder if we could spend a few moments talking about your preparation for this case in the last few months and weeks leading up to the argument.
Well, getting ready for a Supreme Court argument is a lot of work. And it begins with a petition for cert asking the court to take the case. As Scott mentioned, all cert petitions face long odds. But Sam and I recognized the potential in this case the moment the Indiana Supreme Court's decision came down. And beginning in November of last year, when it came down, we began preparing a comprehensive petition to the court, pointing out that there was an important split among courts across the country about whether the excessive fines clause applied within their state's borders. Once the court granted cert in June of 2018, there at the end of last term, we began feverishly preparing our merits brief, and that involved several months of historical research. We pulled in attorneys from across IJ, as well as employees in our strategic research business that helped us make the case for the excessive fines clause applying to the states and for the court taking a hard look at this issue of civil forfeiture and out-of-control fines and fees. We wrapped up the briefing process. When you're the petitioner in the Supreme Court, you write two briefs, the blue brief, the opening brief, and the yellow reply brief. Sam and I prepared those briefs, and as soon as we were done with them, began an intense period of preparing for oral argument. We did internally, I believe it was 5 moots at IJ, and externally we did 4 moots at the University of Washington, where I went to law school here in Seattle. We went to Harvard, Northwestern, and Georgetown right before the argument. And those external moots are really important so that we can get out of our silo, get out of our libertarian bubble, and see what other people are thinking the questions will be, how they're viewing the case. It's a great deal of fun, but like I said at the beginning, it's a tremendous amount of work that someone like Tyson normally couldn't afford.
No doubt, and it paid off in a big way with the argument we'll talk about in just a minute. But Sam, I'd like to turn back to you to talk a little bit about working with Tyson and the preparation that went into, you know, this guy that you said lived in rural Indiana, ready to for one of the biggest stages in the world, the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yeah, well, Tyson just did a phenomenal job from day one on this. So all of IJ's clients, of course, have to be prepared to litigate the case, not just in court, but in the court of public opinion. And that's doubly true when we're up in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. And I don't think it was natural for Tyson to all of a sudden become a national spokesperson for criminal justice reform. It's not natural for a lot of people to get calls from the Washington Post and from other, you know, big news outlets. But Tyson, you know, worked with people in our communications team, John Kramer, other folks here, to get him comfortable talking about his story and talking about why this case was important to him. And just over the past few weeks, he's been on calls with the Associated Press, with Nina Totenberg at NPR, with the Washington Post, with all these big names when it comes to analyzing the Supreme Court's work, and he's just knocked it out of the park every time. I think in part that's because we helped him get comfortable doing that, not because we needed to train him. He really was a natural, but because I think we helped him feel confident enough to go out there and tell his story, which is a really important story.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it was so encouraging, too. I mean, here's a fellow that has struggled in his life, and he really did step up. It's a little bit of a different type of client than we usually take on. You know, we pick our clients very carefully. Usually in our forfeiture cases, there have been people that have had no involvement in criminal activity. Obviously, Tyson had some here, but, you know, unfortunately, it's a kind of a story of today where people struggle with opioid addiction, start on pills, and then move on to other things. But he turned his life around, and it was great to see him at the court, and people wanted to meet him and get their picture taken with him after the argument. And I think it was not just a great thing that he did for the Constitution, but just a great kind of personal growth experience for him as well, and that was really encouraging to see. Let's turn back to Wesley in the lead-up right to the argument. Did you have any final thoughts or preparation that you did right before the argument started last Wednesday?
Well, of course, at that point, we're just eager to do it. You know, we've been preparing for so long. There's this intense feeling of let's go do this. So, you know, the morning of is just kind of a anxious waiting period where all you want to do is get in there and do your thing. A couple of days before, I think, is really the key inflection point for preparation. Are we going to go in there confident, or are we going to go in there less than fully confident? And we had a great day 2 days before the argument where we went and watched the Supreme Court arguments that day, got a feel for the room, for what the justices were hearing, what they were worried about in a different kind of case, again, trying to get a bit out of our silo. And then Sam and I, with our colleague Jeff Rose, just spent an intensive afternoon mooting all of our questions, honing all of our answers one more time, and coming to a point of satisfaction that we were ready to go. Jeff and I then did our traditional pre-argument run. This time it was from IJ's headquarters in Arlington, Virginia, all the way down to the steps of the Supreme Court. And all the way along, of course, Jeff is grilling me and making me answer questions while I'm panting, trying to keep up with him. Really, the only thing that went amiss for me, I'm happy to say, was a kind of wardrobe problem. I had a tie that I'd carefully picked out for my argument, which, when my dry cleaning returned the day before the argument, had been destroyed, as so often happens with a tie. And so I hustled over to Union Station the night before and found myself a good replacement tie, and that part of it at least came off without a hitch.
There always has to be some type of wardrobe malfunction before a big trial or argument date. And I didn't know about Jeff both physically and mentally exhausting you right before the argument then too, which is totally his style for it. So, well, let's talk a little bit about the argument itself. And Wesley, since you presented first, we were the petitioner, so we got to go first. What were the key points that we wanted to convey to the justices, and how did that play out during the argument, and kind of your take on it?
Well, it was very important to us to keep the court on task and focused on the issue of whether the excessive fines clause applied to the states. The path to victory for us, for Tyson, was to pitch the case as an issue of constitutional housekeeping. The court had five times over the last 30 years remarked that they thought the excessive fines clause applied to the states, and this was the opportunity to settle that uncertainty and to do so decisively without getting sidetracked. Our opponents from the state of Indiana were focused on some collateral issues that are important to IJ but just weren't presented to the court that day, and so we had to work hard to keep the justices focused and on task. I'm happy to say, anticipated every single question that we got. We knew that we were going to have to wrestle, that the justices were wrestling with this question of whether a forfeiture is actually a fine within the meaning of the excessive fines clause. And the court had said that decisively in a case called Austin 25 years earlier, but still it was conceptually a difficult thing. So we came up with this concept of this is not a labeling game. The government can't just call what is fundamentally a fine a forfeiture or anything else. What matters is the substance, and the court isn't going to be hoodwinked by a sort of labeling game to work around the Constitution. We knew that the Chief Justice and Justice Alito were going to be disinclined to believe that this forfeiture was excessive, so we aimed to make two things really clear to the more conservative wing of the court. First, that this wasn't an issue that the court needed to reach, right? We were focused just on does the excessive fines clause apply to any kind of fine or forfeiture in the states. And second, yeah, this forfeiture is excessive. Two state courts held that. The judge on the ground in rural Grant County believed that this was excessive in light of Tyson's relatively minor drug offense. And just because there have been a lot of harsh forfeitures in the past, which is a fact, that doesn't mean that there should be more harsh forfeitures today. I mean, we used to draw and quarter people, but at some point we became better than that. And the same should be true for property rights today. While there weren't issues raised that we weren't ready to address, Justice Breyer, as he characteristically does, did confuse me a little bit, opening a line of questioning about the cruel and unusual punishment clause. And the candid truth is that the cruel and unusual punishment clause case law is a mess. And Breyer and Sotomayor, Justices Breyer and Sotomayor, seem to be communicating during the case to their colleagues that there's something absurd about protecting a convicted criminal's private property more carefully than the court has protected innocent people's property. And that is absurd. We agree, as we ultimately pointed out in the argument. But you can't just come out and say that immediately in a Supreme Court argument. So we had to try to answer the question. And the fact is, it's hard to square the circle and explain why an innocent person can lose their property under civil forfeiture, why they're treated more harshly than criminals are. And as we told the court in the Timms argument, that is something that one day the court will have to address.
Well, I think a lot of people have this idea that, you know, when you go to the court, the justices sit there and listen to your impassioned oratory and listening very carefully. And, of course, that's not the case at all. And, you, Wesley, I think you got out about 3 or 4 sentences, which is more than a lot of folks do before you're bombarded with questions. And it's almost like being in a semicircular firing squad for 30 minutes. But you made so many great points during it. They let you make those points. Of course, as you mentioned, especially Chief Justice Roberts and Alito, Justice Alito had some somewhat skeptical questions for you. But I think it's fair to say, Sam, that Wesley had a little bit of an easier time at the court than the Solicitor General for the state of Indiana. So why don't you talk to us a little bit about how he fared at the court that day?
Yeah, so the Solicitor General had a pretty tough time, which I think highlights something unique about this particular IJ case, because 99% of our cases, we're the ones who are really pushing the envelope, trying to persuade courts to cabin or overrule precedent, and the government's kind of standing there on the high ground, aiming down at us. With this case, though, we're the ones in the position of saying, just confirm what you've said before time and again. And it's the state of Indiana that had to come in and make these really counterintuitive arguments. For example, you know, that the excessive fines clause doesn't apply to the states, but all of the surrounding clauses apply to the states. And I think the argument that they really kind of hitched their wagon to and they got a lot of pushback on was this notion that even if the excessive fines clause prevents the federal government from excessively forfeiting people's property, it shouldn't prevent the states from excessively forfeiting people's property. And that, I think, is just intuitively wrong. There's not two different Eighth Amendments, just like there's not two different First Amendments. So, Wesley, I think, got 4 sentences out before he got interrupted. The Solicitor General got, like, 1 sentence, maybe 1 sentence out. Before Justice Gorsuch jumped in with just a really devastating question, basically asking the Solicitor General, why shouldn't you lose? Justice Gorsuch really homed in on, are you really telling us that this clause, that the Bill of Rights doesn't apply to the states?
Really? 2018,
exactly.
Are you really saying?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the Solicitor General, I think, pushed back as best he could, but that really set the momentum for his argument. Justice Kavanaugh also expressed incredulity that we're still having this fight. Justices Breyer and Sotomayor were also kind of questioning the potential for abuse of civil forfeiture. And Justice Sotomayor even suggested that the state of Indiana might be positioning themselves to bring back the Star Chamber from, the 1640s in England, which is, I don't think, a good position to be defending that. So that's basically how the state's argument went, and we're really happy with how it went.
Yeah, when Supreme Court justices are analogizing what you're defending to the Star Chamber of medieval England, it's been a rough day at the court. So it was obviously an exciting and encouraging argument, but the most important thing is the final outcome of it. And Wesley, I just wanted to turn to you before we kind of wrap this up and go to some questions that people submitted and then calls that questions that people might have who are on the line for it. So what is your assessment, Wesley, of where the various justices stand and what do you think is going to be the likely outcome in the case?
Well, on the question of whether the court should incorporate the Eighth Amendment, I count at least 6 votes, which is more than enough to win. With regard to some sort of broader statement about forfeiture, the justices seem to fall into 3 basic camps. There are those who aren't going to want to address it. I think that's Justice Kagan, and with some possibility that the chief joins her. There are those who are likely to use this case as an opportunity to condemn modern civil forfeiture practices, and I think that's Justice Gorsuch, Justice Sotomayor, and Justice Thomas, all of whom have been very critical of the government in this area, including at the argument. And then there are those who may want to try to rein in their colleagues' condemnation of forfeiture practices, and I think that's definitely Justice Alito and possibly Chief Justice Roberts as well. What's really special about this case is that in a hyper-partisan time, even in the judiciary, there's a unique left-right alliance on the key issues in this case, most importantly reflected by the justices. You've got Gorsuch, Sotomayor, and Thomas likely to line up behind major changes in the court's civil forfeiture policies. But you've also got just a tremendous cross-section of America supporting us as amici to the court. We put together 18 briefs in support of Tyson, one more from some scholars that was nominally in support of neither party. That was 19 substantial briefs of people writing in with non-traditional alliances like the Southern Poverty Law Center together with the Cato Institute. The NAACP filed a brief. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce filed a brief. So this was really a nice moment for the institution of the court, and I think they appreciated the opportunity to show that this isn't just about politics. It's also about the Constitution and what the rules are supposed to be in this country.
Thank you very much, Wesley and Sam and Scott. As Scott mentioned, we would like to start taking questions in just a moment. If you're on the line and you have a question, just press star on your phone and you'll be added to the queue. Again, just press star and we can take your question live. We also had a few submitted in advance that we'll get to. But before we turn to those, Scott, could you talk a little bit about what is next? Where is IJ going to go in light of how things went down in Tim's last week?
Well, as Wesley said, we're very hopeful for a favorable outcome in Tim's, but we want this just to be really the first in a series of cases that the court takes on to fundamentally reconsider the practice of civil forfeiture. Justice Thomas indicated in an opinion last year that the time was ripe for the court to do that. Several of the justices seemed poised to do that in some of the questions that they raised in Tim's, and we want this to not only be a favorable outcome to stop draconian forfeiture practices, but also for the court to look once again at, for instance, the constitutionality of seizing the property of wholly innocent people, which the court unfortunately upheld in the Bennis decision from 1996. Justice Thomas specifically noted that decision. He thought it was wrong. The court should reconsider it. We are carefully selecting cases to look at that issue. We're also, of course, challenging the perverse financial incentive that exists in forfeiture law. The court in New Mexico struck that down in one of our cases earlier this year. We want to get that issue up for the before the Supreme Court. So this we see as I said, the first in a series of cases that the court takes on to look at this issue again. Hopefully, we will also get some good language in this case that will be helpful for our work on challenging oppressive fines and fees schemes that are proliferating. As I mentioned, that's a growing property rights area for us that we're challenging, and hopefully we'll get some good ammunition and bases to use in future lawsuits in courtrooms throughout the country.
Thank you, Scott. Now let's turn to questions from IJ supporters. Again, if you are on the line and you have a question, just press star and we'll get you into the queue. We had a question sent in advance from Dan in New Jersey, who just generally expressed some skepticism at the Chief Justice's statement during the argument that seizing Tyson's car made sense as an asset used in the crime. Could one of you talk about that and what the rationale behind his comment was and maybe potential problems with it?
Sure. So I think that skepticism is well-founded. What the Chief Justice's question went to is this fiction in the world of civil forfeiture that if property is an instrumentality of a crime, if it has some kind of connection with a criminal offense, then the government can take it, even regardless of whether the owner of the property actually committed the offense. And that's really the root of some of the main injustices with civil forfeiture. And it's something that, of course, we at IJ are combating day in and day out. And it's becoming an increasing problem over recent decades. For example, in the 1840s, you see civil forfeiture mainly being used to combat piracy and other pretty esoteric areas. But today, you know, any state or local law enforcement official can take property, can take enormous amounts of property, and can do so for increasingly minor crimes. So this is a serious problem and one that we're doing our best to address.
Thank you, Sam. Our first question, our live question, will be from Dick in New Jersey. Dick, you are live. What's your question?
I said that independent of, you know, the court's tradition not to issue an opinion broader than the instant issue before them, independent of that, why is it that the court has a reluctance to deal with civil forfeiture?
Well, I think that I'll mention, so you can jump in a minute. You know, I think courts do like to let issues percolate for a number of years, and they kind of let it play out, and then they oftentimes will start getting involved and do it in a series of cases where they feel like the time is now ripe, where we have to look at this once again, and the impact of those cases can be quite broad and quite sweeping, but the court does like to operate in a more incremental fashion to not do these more sweeping opinions. I think the court is ripe to look at this issue about the forfeiture of wholly innocent property owners, the property of wholly innocent owners. That was something that they just got wrong over 20 years ago. I think they recognize that. And if they went for that, in addition to looking at the perverse financial incentive in forfeiture, if they address those two questions, then a vast majority of civil forfeitures that exist today would be extinguished, and we would get the result that we're ultimately seeking, which is the end of civil forfeiture or its radical reform.
Thank you, Dick. We have a question from Henry in Florida. Henry, you're live.
Yes, I'm just wondering where the court gets around due process when they take property from somebody, whether it be an individual or a corporation. I understand that sometimes it's considered to be part of a crime, but still, it seems to me that the due process would mean that somebody would have to prove something to someone.
Thank you, Henry.
Yeah, I'll just jump in on that again. You know, that's a great question, and that's where the court got it wrong in Venice, because that's when they signed off on taking the property from a wholly innocent property owner. This is a case involving a woman who co-owned a car with her husband. He used the car to solicit the services of a prostitute in Detroit. She said, I obviously didn't consent to this. I had no knowledge that he was going to use the car for this purpose. And the court said, that's too bad. Civil forfeiture has existed for a long time. And that's where they really get the history wrong. And that's what Justice Thomas was alerted to. Yes, civil forfeiture has existed for a long time, but they were tied to admiralty cases or piracy cases that Sam had mentioned previously, where a government could not get jurisdiction over a person because the person might be in another country or on the high seas. So they let a limited purpose for the government to go after the property. But now it's not tied to the necessities of those cases at all. It's just a convenient way for the government to raise revenue. And so it strayed so far from its historical origins that the court should look at this and rule the way you had said, which is it violates due process to take the property of wholly innocent owners.
We have a question from Joy in Massachusetts. Joy, what is your question?
Hi. I was wondering if someone could elaborate more on the Dennis precedent that you mentioned. I think that might also have been the previous question. If I'm redundant, then don't worry about it.
Yeah, that was what I just mentioned, the Venice precedent. That was the precedent from 1996, which upheld the taking of property from innocent property owners like Tina Venice. for it. So that's, you know, goes to the one of the cores of this issue that I think the court is going to look at again, and we are litigating cases in with the goal of getting that issue up before the court again.
A reminder to those on the phone, if you have a question, press star. We have time for a couple more. Before we take another live question, we had one more that was submitted in advance from Marjorie in Georgia, who wanted to know what we know about the acting attorney general, Matthew Whitaker. What is his position on forfeiture?
Well, we don't know for sure. I haven't read any public statements about that he said about civil forfeiture, but the hope is that he's better than Jeff Sessions, who was an unapologetic defender of civil forfeiture. That was true when he was a senator, when we first started getting some hearings on this, and we had senators from across the ideological spectrum, from Dianne Feinstein to Mike Lee to Rand Paul, that were all talking about how outrageous civil forfeiture was. But Senator Sessions at the time was saying that he thought that this was a great power that needed to be protected. Sessions undid some of the modest reforms that the previous administration had put in to curb federal civil forfeiture reform. So I don't think it could get much worse than Jeff Sessions, and hopefully he'll look at this with a different light and read what so many people have written about civil forfeiture and start reconsidering what the federal government is doing in this area.
Last question is from Steve in Nevada. Steve, what's your question? You're live.
Hi, guys. My question is about the Privileges or Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment, which was kind of swayed by the slaughterhouse cases in the 19th century. And I know you can't base this case on its revival, but I just wondered what you thought the prospects of its revival going forward might be in the reasonably foreseeable future.
Wesley, you want to jump in on that? That was one of the questions
sure.
that at least Justice Gorsuch had mentioned in the beginning.
Yeah, we actually have a privileges or immunities argument in this case. It is tailored to Justice Thomas and his concurrence in the McDonald versus Chicago case, where in 2010 the court incorporated the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms against the state. Justice Thomas at that time, uniquely among the justices, believed that the Privileges or Immunities Clause rather than the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment is the correct basis for incorporation. To try to get his vote, we needed to make that argument, but we were also and remain keenly interested to know where Justice Gorsuch and Justice Kavanaugh stand on that issue, because they weren't on the court at the time. Very, very excitingly, we have a case that's coming before the Supreme Court on January 16th of 2019, in just about 5 weeks, which makes a privileges or immunities argument to try to strike down a Tennessee rule that if you're going to sell liquor in that state, you have to have lived there for at least 2 years. And my Seattle, Washington office mate, Michael Bendis, is poised to argue in that case that the Privileges or Immunities Clause doesn't allow that kind of argument. So, you know, it's a 140-year-old precedent, but we're on the march to try to correct some of its more extreme overstatements.
Last question. We had time for one more. David in Florida, you are live.
Hi there. Not really a question, but I read the transcript of the oral argument, and unlike many cases where the justices are really making their points and arguing, it seems like they were sincerely seeking input. They were asking questions about what they had said in other cases. They were asking how to resolve issues and using counsel as a resource for them, and it was quite impressive. I ended up looking up who Wesley Hoddit was. I thought I'd find some 70-year-old guy with no hair, and I just want to make the point that I thought you did a phenomenal job, and in answering the questions, it seems like you were incredibly prepared.
Well, thank you, sir. Of course, I was merely the spokesperson for a huge team of people at IJ, no one more so than Sam Gedge. But there were, I think, people from every branch of our organization that contributed to this in some way or another. And it's just a tremendous honor to be trusted by them and to be trusted by someone like Tyson Thames to take their case to the Supreme Court. Thank you for your comment. I really appreciate it.
That's one of the things that we pride ourselves on, is giving our attorneys significant responsibility early on. And you know, this is a team effort, but Wesley really stepped up. He is a younger guy. He's not a lion of the Supreme Court that some people think you need to do a good job. That's not the case. People know the issue. Like, our attorneys are always so prepared going into a case. We know they're going to knock it out of the park, and that's exactly what Wesley, Sam, and the team did, and we're hoping for a very favorable outcome before the end of June.
Thank you, David. And with that question, we're out of time for today. Thanks to Scott, Sam, and Wesley for your insights, and to all those on the phone for joining the discussion. If you missed any part of the conversation, we will have links to an audio recording of the call available next week. We'll post those online. And if you have any questions or comments that we weren't able to get to, stay on the line and you can leave a voicemail and we can respond to you personally. If you'd like, you can also email me at mhildreth@ij.org and we can respond to you directly that way as well. Thank you again for your support for IJ, and have a great evening.